So, as Helen said, tonight we're going to go through the Bible, and hopefully by the end of our talk, you should be a little bit more familiar with it. I hope you'll have a plan for reading it, and a plan that will skip over the tough parts, but not leave out the main parts of the story. So there are different ways to read the Bible. If you remember from Ben's talk, he had a concordance, and he had this, and he had a that, and after you have a bunch of books around your side, you're ready to read the Bible. Most of us find that to be intimidating, but that is the scholarly approach. And when we do that, we use modern forms of analysis, which are called criticism, because that's the German word for analysis. And the first Bible scholars who kind of made a profession of this were German Protestants at the University of Berlin and other places like that. And when we do that, we are looking for historical context. You can tell these guys because they'll say something like, well, Jesus was a first century Jew, and they're trying to give you context for the story from the Bible. You can look at the story over time, that's what diachronic means, or look at it all at one time, that's what synchronic means, and these are good fancy words for you to throw around and impress people. Textual informed criticism is looking at the actual words themselves. You'll spot recurring patterns, like there's a pattern where in the book from the Old Testament, when they talk about God, they use the word Yahweh. Another section seems to use the word Elohim when they're talking about God. And then the form of it, is it in a poem, is it prose, is it a song, what type of narrative might it be? And then you learn things like in the Hebrew languages, the Semitic languages, they don't have the comparative and the superlative. So they can't say warm, warmer, warmest. So in order to convey that it's the warmest thing, they say warm, 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 which is why you see in some of the scriptures, you know, holy, 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 because they don't have a way to sort of say holiest. And it's from these types of analysis, so you can read the Bible sort of as a scholar. You can also read it as spiritual reading too. And we do that privately in something that we touched on, I think, in the prayer talk called Lectio Divina, which just means spiritual reading, where you take a little piece of scripture and you read it, and then you sort of sit with it, and then you read it again, and then you sort of sit with it, and there's a lot of sitting with it, sort of like a cow chewing its cud. And God will speak to you through that. That's why it's spiritual reading. And then also we do spiritual reading collectively when we the lectionary, that cycle of readings that we have of 3 years of 3 years of Sundays and 2 years of daily readings. So scholarly reading and spiritual reading are excellent ways to do it. But I'm going to talk about the most basic way to read the Bible, and that is to know the story. And it's more important that you know the story than to know the proper pronunciation of Hebrew names, and it's more important that you know the main characters in their stories. Later, you can become a master of genealogy and geography. If you crack open the Old Testament, if you flip 5 pages, you will come across a list of names. And you will not like it. And that might make you close it. So my advice to you is when you hit that, you just turn the page. It was important to them to make sure you knew. And if you grew up in the Old South, you know, that's, Beauregard, son of Beauregard, son of Beauregard, son of Beauregard. That's how you know they're an old family from wherever. Well, that's the Old Testament kind of approach, and it's important to them, but it may not be important to you, so just skip over. And also things like there's lots of sections of the design of the temple, what the cloth should look like. That's kind of interesting to us because that's kind of why we do what we do in terms of decorating our clergy and our buildings. But it's not part of the story that's super important to you. So I'm going to present a path through the Bible. Okay? And this, I've got the handouts out there, so you don't have to write all this stuff down if you don't want to. But there's 72 books in the Bible, so I've obviously left out a lot of good ones, and I've left out some of my own personal favorites. All of you men are automatically invited to join us Wednesday mornings at 7:30 for the men's Bible study. It happens right here. And there's some great books we've been reading, and there's like a Disney, like Disney should make a movie of the Book of Tobit, we decided. It's such a great story, and it's not on this list. But this will get you going, and I think the lectionary is mostly drawn from these books, so it'll make the lectionary come a little bit alive for you as well. So my recommendation is you first read one of the three synoptic gospels. We use the word synoptic because these three gospels look at the earthly ministry of Jesus in the same way. They even use some of the same words. And I recommend you read Mark because it's the shortest. Or Matthew, it's got some of the born in the majors part of the story in there. So that you have a sense of how Jesus moved from Nazareth, which is up in Galilee, to Jerusalem, and finally to the cross on Good Friday and the resurrection on Easter Sunday. Then I recommend you go and read the beginning of the story. The book of Genesis is the first book in the Bible, so it's very easy to find. And if you don't have an Old Testament, you don't have a Bible. Okay? You need to have the thicker book. Genesis is very long, but it also covers a very long time. And I'd encourage you to read these as family stories, and don't expect them to be like modern histories. If you've got, I'm going to make him up, Uncle Billy in your family, who tells the family story about how your family came to America, and if you think about it, he doesn't always get every fact exactly correct. He uses unrealistic numbers when he talks about a lot of people. We all do that, don't we? I waited a million hours for my license, or I'll be there in a sec, right? We don't really mean that. We just try to convey a sense of size. But that's what those early stories in the Bible are like. They're like family stories that communicate something more important than dates and times. The next book is Exodus. Exodus is the story of getting away from slavery in Egypt. And it's a story that's told and retold many times in the later writings in the Bible. Much of what the prophets were saying later to those wayward kings was basically, do you remember the time God saved us and brought us out of Egypt? That's mostly what the prophets were saying, and they wag their finger most of the time when they talked. So after you've read a gospel, and you've read Genesis, and you've read Exodus, I recommend you go back and read the other synoptic gospel, which is Luke, which is a two-parter. The second part of the Gospel of Luke is called the Book of the Acts of the Apostles. And if you've read that, you'll have a really good sense of the life of Jesus and the early life of the church after he ascended into heaven. I'm making you move around a lot here. But then you go back and you continue to follow the Israelites into the Promised Land and how they eventually messed it up. Numbers, the book of Numbers, is mostly about the tribes wandering around the Arabian Peninsula for 40 years before they can enter Canaan, which is the land of promise. And then the book of Joshua is the story of taking the land of Canaan. You can skim Judges to get a sense of the Israelites' inability to remain faithful to God's law. And then they finally decided that they wanted to be like other nations and have a king. 1 and 2 Samuel is the story of Saul as the first king, and then David becoming king after him. And you will read some of the greatest hits here. David and Goliath, David being hunted by Saul, and then David and Bathsheba. And 1 and 2 Kings gets us to Israel after David's death. The kingdom under King Solomon was peaceful and prosperous, but it wasn't faithful to God, and at his death it split into two kingdoms. The 10 northern tribes were called Israel, and they had better land and were generally richer. The southern area was called Judah, and it had the temple in Jerusalem. Now I think you should go back to the New Testament and read the fourth gospel, the Gospel according to John. It's written in a very different style than the other three, and scholars believe it was written a bit later than the others. John assumes that his readers will recognize his references, which you probably will now since you've read so much of the Old Testament. Then go back to the Old Testament and sample some of the prophets and some of the wisdom books. As I mentioned, prophets pretty much say the same thing, and they just say it at different times and to different people. After you get the pattern, you can pick up some of the highlights from Isaiah and Jeremiah and Hosea. Those are three of the bigger books. The prophets are not organized chronologically. They are organized pretty much by the size of the scroll and then in order of importance. So Isaiah is the longest one, which is why it's at the front. But Amos is the oldest, is the first of the prophets. Wisdom books are books of wise sayings, the kind of things that intellectual men of leisure might write about. And as the cultures of their overlords changed, the Israelites were touched by these cultures, and their touches crept into their sacred writings. So there are themes from Babylonian, from Persian, and even Greek thought that one can find in some of the wisdom books like Job, Proverbs, and Sirach. And you should begin to read the Psalms. The Psalms is the songbook of the church. And it is the heart of the Liturgy of the Hours, which we discussed a week or two ago. After you've done all that, go read whatever grabs you. There's some history left to cover. The Babylonian exile and the return. That's the books of Nehemiah and Ezra. And then the influence of the Greek Empire. That's 1st and 2nd Maccabees. And there are shorter prophetic writings that foretell the Messiah, books like Micah and Zephaniah. So that will keep you busy for a while, but we dodged some of the... I didn't mention Leviticus, and I didn't mention Deuteronomy, and that's on purpose. Okay. But I think I want to spend a few minutes just looking at this so you have a sense of, you know, where we're talking about. I'm going to use the point of that one. But so this is Africa. This is Russia and China. This is Europe, okay? So this is the eastern edge of the Mediterranean Sea. CNN is always showing you scenes from here, I think, so that's probably might be helpful. This little white thing that says Ur of the Chaldees is the Arabian Peninsula. Now, just in case you don't know your geography, okay? You can't really read that, but this line, that's 300 miles, so you get a sense of how compact this area is. What you can't see from a kind of a flat map is the terrain changes and the climate changes. Jerusalem is about 1,000 to 1,500 feet above sea level. About 15 miles behind it, the Dead Sea is 600 feet below sea level. So moving around was a lot of up and down. It wasn't just walking across. There's lots of rain and beautiful places to grow stuff here, and this is all pretty deserty right here, and they're 50 miles apart. That's one of the reasons why you might want to have some kind of a contextual reference, is to get a sense of that as you're reading through the story. But the main figures came from this area, the land of Ur. They went over into this area, the land of Canaan. They bounced around a bit. They end up going down to Egypt for a long time. They come back. They get bumped around by people from this area, which is called Assyria or Syria. They get bumped around by this area, which is the Babylonians. They get bumped around by this guy, the Greeks, and finally the Romans come. Okay? So that's the area that they're operating in. And the map is in the handout, so you can take a picture if you want to, but you don't need to. Okay? I just wanted you to get a feel for the area that we're talking about. Also, when did these things happen? And this time frame is It gets tighter because we have more external sources, but this is just kind of to give you a feel for it. Some of these creation stories, what's more important is the nature of creation than trying to date it. You know? Adam and Eve were not live tweeting things, okay? So it's just, it's really like, you remember how the Star Wars movies start? That's a good way to think of dates in here. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, okay? So a long time ago, God created everything. We had the flood, Abram, who becomes Abraham, Jacob and Joseph. That's all, you know, at least 2 centuries before Christ. Then we hop to the next most important guy is Moses, and he's the main figure in the books of Exodus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Then we move to Samuel and Saul and David, so we're 1,000 years before Jesus. Then we have his son Solomon, and it breaks into the 2 kingdoms. We start to see some prophets like Elijah and Elisha. Then the kingdom splits in two, and then the foreigners overrun it, so we have them kick them out. We have the exile and the diaspora. Diaspora just means the spreading out. This is how we ended up with communities of Jews in all the major cities around the Mediterranean, which is why then thousands of years later, 500 years later, Paul can write to the church in Corinth and the church in Rome, is because they got spread around a little bit 500 years before. Then they are allowed to return. And then Hellenism, the Greek word for Greek is Hellas. So that's when you see the word Hellenism, it means Greek culture. Okay? So that's when these things happen. All right. And of course, I am going to promote some books. These are all approachable. The book by, I think he's a Benedictine, I think. Lawrence Boat was written in the mid-80s and then updated recently. It's a great kind of handy resource, touches on things like what was the nature of the Canaanite religion and things like that to kind of give you some color. He also is kind of recommending, if you're interested in this, read these chapters in this book. So that's a great guide. Just recently issued this year is a bigger, it's like this thick, and I think it's $46, so you may prefer the Lawrence Boat. But Brant Petra, who teaches our seminarians at the seminary, Notre Dame Seminary in New Orleans, partnered with another professor, John Bergsma, for a Catholic introduction to the Bible, and this is the Old Testament section. They're going to do a New Testament book next. And then this book by Romano Guardini is called The Lord, and it's really kind of a series of meditations or reflections that Guardini wrote using the New Testament as, you know, he starts reading the Gospel of Luke, say, and he just has some meditations on it. It's a fantastic thing to read next to the New Testament as you're reading. So those are 3 books. If you bought the 2 on the Edge, you'd spend $35. Okay? I think that is all the slides. Okay. So let's begin at the beginning of the book of Genesis, which is the first book in the Bible. There are 2 creation stories. In the first one, notice that God makes everything out of nothing. This is much more important than the details or how scientific it seems to be. We cannot call ourselves Christians if we do not believe that all existence is bound up in and by God's will. He willed everything into being. And when he wills the end of creation, it will all go away. Nothing that exists exists without him. And that includes even our children. Mothers and fathers cooperate with God's gift of life. We should never forget that what makes us alive came from our God rather than from our parents. And this understanding is at the heart of the Christian understanding of the human person, and it underpins the pro-life message that all Christians necessarily embrace. So that's where we get it, from that creation story. In the creation story, it is clear that the human person is the pinnacle of God's creation. near the end of the very first chapter, Scripture explains man, and by man I mean mankind, to include both male and female, as created in God's image. We are the only thing created in God's image. We are His greatest creation. He gave us will, which is the ability and the freedom to choose, and He gave us intellect, which is the ability and the freedom to use reason and grow in knowing. In the creation story, it is clear that God gave a purpose to His creation and an order to it. Be fruitful and multiply, He says. God gives mankind dominion over the rest of creation. And this is where we get the idea of stewardship. We, as God's greatest creation, have an obligation to take care of it. This is the source for Christian wildlife conservation and protection. That's because God gave us the responsibility of taking care of the rest of creation. Right after the creation story, there is another creation story. And the second story in order is, according to scholars, the older story. And I mention this to remind us that the Bible is a collection of stories. And like many other collections, sometimes the collector decided that the story needs to be in there, even if it seems a bit repetitive. There's something in the second creation story that needs to be told if we are to understand the fundamental relationship between God and mankind. Whereas in the first story, creation is presented in an order that puts man after everything else. If you remember, the God said, "Let there be light," right? And the last thing He does is let us make man in our image. In the second story, man is the first thing created, and it is mankind that gives a name to every other creature. The giving of a name is a significant action that indicates the authority of the name giver, and it indicates the purpose of the one to whom the name is given. So when Adam said, "That's a rhinoceros," it's communicating that Adam has the power to name it, and the rhinoceros gets his function from being named a rhino. But in giving all the names to all the other creatures, it becomes clear in the story that no other creature is appropriate to the man, Adam. And Adam just means man. God, in His love for His creation, takes from the man part of his essence and makes for him a suitable helpmate. And there are two things I want to address about this particular story. The Hebrew word here that is translated as helpmate is only used in the rest of the scripture in the context of helping one go to heaven. So the suitable helpmate to Adam is the one who will help him be with God. The second point I'd like to make is that up until the point Adam meets Eve, the story has been told to us in straight prose. It has been up to this point a recitation of activities and actions in declarative statements. But when Adam sees Eve, he breaks into song. He says, "Bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." The Hebrew word for woman is isha, and the Hebrew word for man is ish. So the connection between the man and woman as words is a bit clearer in the original language. But the sight of Eve is so profound that Adam can't be contained in just straight prose. Adam and Eve are given great freedom. Everything in the garden is theirs, except the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But there is a tempter in the garden, and he tempts Adam and Eve by appealing to presumption and to pride. They, in turn, decide to obey the tempter rather than to obey God. Whereas before they ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, they were blissfully naked as they walked with God. After they had eaten, they are quickly embarrassed by their nakedness, and they make covers for themselves. They hide from God. And when God confronts them, they make excuses and try to deflect the blame. But those who have turned away from God cannot be in close relationship with Him. This is the essence of the free will that He has given us. This original decision to turn away from God is what we call original sin. Adam and Eve passed on to us the wounds of this original sin, which are addressed in the sacrament of baptism. But even after baptism, those wounds are manifested in our ongoing inclination to sin. And we call that inclination to sin concupiscence. Adam and Eve must leave the garden. But even as God is sending them out of the garden, He tells them of how He is going to bring them home. There is an image in the third chapter of the book of Genesis, which connects to an image in the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation. So at the beginning of the first book, we are connected to the book at the very end of the whole Bible. Adam and Eve conceive sons, Cain and Abel, and there is discord between the two, and eventually one kills the other. The sin of Adam and Eve has already affected their children. Time goes by and generations go on, and then we meet Noah. The people have become so sinful and corrupt that God has decided to cleanse the whole earth with the great flood. But Noah and his family are good people, a remnant that God would save, and a remnant that would give mankind a chance to return home to a right relationship with God. Time goes by and generations go on, and we meet Abram, a man from the land of Ur. Abram is not alone. He has Sarah, his wife, and Lot, his nephew. And after God speaks to him, Abram sets off with his family from the land of Ur to the land of Canaan, modern-day Israel, which God has promised to him. Abram is blessed materially and lives in the land of Canaan. Abram and Lot are doing so well, there's not enough pasture for the two of them. So Abram suggests that they split up. Lot is given the first choice, and he chooses the Jordan Valley. So Abram stays in the land of Canaan. Throughout these stories, Abram has been able to have a dialogue with God. And eventually he asks God, how is it that He has promised generations after generations when he and his wife are really old and they don't even have one child? God sends His angels, and you need to remember that an angel is just a messenger, that's what the word means. So He might be in a human form, or maybe He has wings and a halo. And the messengers promise Sarah that when they return in a year's time, she will have given birth to a son. Sarah laughs at them. And so when her son is indeed born, he is given the name Isaac, which means he laughs. This is the time that God has made His covenant with Abram, whom He gives a new name, Abraham. And He promises that Abraham will be the father of many nations, and that He will give to Abraham and to his descendants the land of Canaan for an everlasting possession, and that He will be their God. That kind of statement of relationship is what a covenant is. There are not many terms in it. It's just that I will be yours and you will be mine. And you see that in our marriage, Christian marriage as well. Later in the story, God tested Abraham. He told him to take his son Isaac, his only son, and go up on the mountain of Moriah and offer him as a burnt offering. Abraham obeys, even to the point of binding his son on top of the wood and raising his knife to take his life, when the angel of the Lord stops him and says, "Now I know that you fear God, for you did not withhold even your son, your only son." The next major character in our story is Jacob, who is the son of Isaac. Jacob is the younger son. His older brother Esau is the one to whom the inheritance of Isaac and Isaac's blessing would normally be given. But Esau doesn't appreciate what is supposed to be his, and in a famous story, trades that inheritance with his brother Jacob for some food. Isaac is by this time blind, And he is deceived by Jacob into giving to Jacob the blessing he intended for Esau. Jacob left Isaac to live with a man named Laban, and he fell in love with Rachel, who was Laban's daughter. Laban accepted the offer of marriage, but at the time for the marriage to be consummated, Jacob was tricked into consummating his marriage with Rachel's older sister, Leah. So Jacob is forced to take Leah as his wife and wait another 7 years before he could take Rachel as his second wife. They had more wives back then. And God blessed Jacob and stayed in relationship with him and appeared to him more than once in dreams and in visions. And God renewed his covenant with his children and gave Jacob a new name, Israel, representing the covenant established at the dawn of creation. He said, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply. And he extended the covenant he made with Abraham. The land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you, and I will give the land to your descendants after you. So Jacob, or Israel, has 12 sons. These are the 12 tribes of Israel. His son Joseph was his favorite, and Joseph had a dream which he shared with his older brothers. His dream was that they would bow down to him. And they decided instead to sell him into slavery to some Egyptian traders. So Joseph went down to Egypt. He endured trials and tribulations, but he was protected and guided by God, and he ended up being the chief counselor to the Pharaoh, where he gave great advice that prepared Egypt for a 7-year famine. During that famine, the Israelites came down to Egypt for food. Here they did indeed bow down to Joseph, though they did not recognize him as their brother. But Joseph recognized them. And after some back and forth, he brought them all to Egypt, where they settled in the region called Goshen. And that's the book of Genesis. We meet Moses in the book of Exodus. We're not going to cover every book like this. The book of Exodus takes place hundreds of years after the death of Joseph. And by this time, the Israelites are considered something of a threat because they are strong and have many children. The Pharaoh decides to enter into some population control and ethnic cleansing by having all the boys killed shortly after their birth. One particular boy in this story is saved, and he is found by the Pharaoh's daughter and given the name Moses. Moses grows up as a prince of Egypt, but he knows he is a Hebrew. After some trouble, Moses has to run away from the Pharaoh's court, and when he comes back, he comes as the leader of the Hebrew people, and he demands that they be released from their slavery and allowed to return to the land of their forefathers. The Pharaoh, of course, is not pleased to lose his immigrant workforce. And so there is a dramatic sequence of plagues and trials sent by God upon the people of Egypt. The final plague is that the angel of death will fly over the land and take the lives of every firstborn male, of man and beast alike. The Hebrews, however, have been told by Moses to get dressed ready for travel, to take a lamb, to eat it mixed with bitter herbs, and to take some of its blood and mark the posts and the lintel of their doors, so that the angel of death will know to pass over their homes and not send death into them. This terrible event spurs Pharaoh to beg Moses to take his people and leave Egypt. But after they are gone, the Pharaoh sends his chariots and charioteers after the Hebrews to put them back into slavery. At the Sea of Reeds, Moses holds up his staff and causes the water to stand still on either side so that the Hebrews can pass through on dry land to the other side. The Lord causes the Egyptians to chase in after the Hebrews, but on the other side, Moses again lifts up his staff and causes the waters to close over the Egyptians and destroy their army. I want you to remember this story at the Easter Vigil, when hopefully the choir will sing this fantastic story about the chariots and the charioteers, and you'll remember that you heard it here. The Hebrews are now what is in modern-day Saudi Arabia, and they go directly to Canaan, which was promised to them. They sent some scouts into the land, and the scouts reported back that the land is filled with giants because they were afraid. And because of their lack of trust in God, the Hebrews must wander around the desert for 40 years because God has decided that none of that generation shall see the promised land. It is here in Saudi Arabia on Mount Sinai that Moses sees the burning bush and brings down the Ten Commandments, only to find that the people have constructed a golden calf and are worshiping it instead of the true God. It is here that the people say they cannot bear to hear the word of God directly from God. So God speaks to Moses, and Moses gives them the laws. And these are the laws in the books of Leviticus and Deuteronomy. After the death of Moses, Joshua leads the Hebrews across the Jordan River into the Promised Land. The story of how the Hebrews conquer the land is captured in the story of the walls of Jericho. The Hebrews don't have an army sufficient to bring down the walls of this fortress and then conquer the city. But God tells them to march around the city blowing their trumpets and carrying the Ark of the Covenant. And sure enough, the walls come tumbling down and the people of Jericho are conquered. Joshua divides the land up among the 12 tribes, and we move to the book of Judges. The book of Judges traces the history of the Israelites after the death of Joshua, and it shows the reader that the people living in the Promised Land had great difficulty remaining faithful to God's law. So not much is new. So God sent judges, a combination of a religious and military leader, to rescue the people and help them learn to live according to the law. But they couldn't maintain it, and they always slipped back, and God would send another judge. It is in the book of Judges that we meet one of the Hebrew heroines who respond to God with confidence and strength when the men fail to trust him. The judge at this time was a woman named Deborah, and she tells Barak, not our former president, from the tribe of Naphtali, to lead his army against Sisera, who is the general of the Canaanite army. That's who they're fighting mostly. The Israelites won that battle in a rout, but Sisera got away, and he hid in the tent of a woman named Jael. She had him hide under a rug, and when he had fallen asleep, she drove a tent peg through his skull with a mallet. And when Barak finally arrives, she says, "Come, I will show you the man you were looking for." So this is the stories in there are not for the squeamish. It's full reveal. The story continues with the first and second books of Samuel, where we meet the prophet Samuel. The story of Samuel's birth and then his call as a prophet is well known, and he becomes the leading religious figure in Israel. So it is to Samuel that the Israelites come asking to have a king and be like other nations. Samuel warns them that a king will ultimately enslave them, but he gives them what they ask for. Saul is the new king of Israel, and he is tall and good-looking and strong and noble. But Saul does not always want to walk with God. In the primary threat, external threat at this time is the Philistines, and they have among their ranks a giant of a man who is known as Goliath. Warfare back then is not as it is now, and so the army spent a great deal of time sort of in camp, looking at each other across the battlefield, but not actually fighting. And during one of those times, the youngest son of Jesse, a boy named David, comes to the camp, and he's a musician, and he plays music which soothes the nerves of King Saul. But David heard the taunts of the Philistines, and was outraged at their lack of respect for the Hebrew God. And you probably know the rest of the story. The The story of David and Goliath is well known because it shows clearly that trust in God was David's true armor and his true sword that allowed him to defeat God's enemies. David is hailed around Israel for his valor, which makes Saul become jealous and antagonistic towards David. David is, for a time, welcomed into the courtly life, and he marries one of Saul's daughters. But then he runs for safety in the hills of Judea because Saul starts chasing after him. Eventually, Saul dies, and David is crowned king and begins to consolidate his land, pushing back the Philistines and the other tribes at the edges of his territory. It is while he is king that we read the story of David's terrible sin with Bathsheba, in which he commits adultery and ultimately murder of Bathsheba's husband Uriah. Nathan has replaced Samuel as prophet, and he brings a story of a little family with one small sheep, which is stolen by the rich family in the town. And David says, "That man should be killed." And Nathan says, "You are the man." So whereas King Saul ran from his sins and tried to hide from God, King David admitted his sin and did penance. Psalm 51 was written by David when he acknowledged his sin to God and asked for forgiveness. King David, a man of strengths and weaknesses, was the model king for whom all successor generations looked, because he always remained in relationship with God. The Jews at the time of Jesus thought they were looking for the new King David, and they thought he would be a military leader, as King David had been. But some recognized that it was the permanent relationship with the Father that marked the true heir of King David in Jesus. David's son was King Solomon, and when asked by God what he desired, the boy asked for wisdom so that he could be a good king. And so God gave him wisdom, but he also gave him peace, and he gave him wealth, and this allowed Solomon to build the temple that David had wanted to build. But Solomon strayed from strict adherence to the faith of his fathers, and he ended up with many wives from foreign faiths, and he began to practice not only the Jewish faith, but all the other ones too. When Solomon died, the land was divided into two kingdoms. 10 tribes of the north occupied the territory known as Samaria, and this included Galilee, where Jesus grew up. 2 tribes occupied the south in the land of Judah. The books 1 and 2 Kings detail the up and down history of the northern kings and the southern kings. There were a few times of renewal, such as King Josiah, but the people of Israel kept mixing with the Canaanites and adopting their religious practices, which included child sacrifice. God sent prophets to call the Israelites to account, but the results were mixed. The prophet Elijah, dominates the story of the prophets with famous events in his life. In one famous episode, Elijah is chased by the evil queen Jezebel. Don't name your daughter Jezebel, because she wants all the priests to serve the foreign god Baal. And there's a famous scene in which Elijah has a competition with these priests to offer a sacrifice by calling on our God to light the fire and burn up the sacrificial animal. After letting the priests of Baal hop around and cut themselves and invoke their god to try to get it to light the wood, they finally give up. Elijah taunts them, says maybe he's taking a nap. Elijah then says, pour a lot of water over all the wood, enough so that it fills up a ditch. And then he prays to God, and the fire comes down and consumes everything. In another story, Elijah is living with a widow who has just a little bit of flour in a jar and a little jar of oil. And he says, make me a cake, which she agrees to do. But by the power of God, that little jar of oil and that little container of flour feeds her and Elijah and her son for a whole year. In another story, Elijah goes up on the mountain to meet God, and he famously meets him not in the powerful wind or in the thunder, but in the still small voice when he stands at the mouth of the cave. Elijah is taken up in a whirlwind, and his follower, Elisha, becomes the principal prophet in Israel. But there are many others, some drawn from the ruling class and others from everyday occupations. Amos is a famous prophet who was called by God from his life as a dresser of sycamores. And all the prophets were given a message from God, and they were compelled to deliver the message. The message is almost always the same, some variation on this. You people are headed in the wrong direction, and you deserve destruction. But God loves his people, and he will protect you. But first, you need to endure some trial and oppression. But hang in there, and God will finally save you. Israel was situated between two powerful political forces, Egypt on the west, which was always a threat, and then the various empires of Syria and Persia to the east. After the kingdom was divided, the kings in the northern area were threatened by the Syrians and then the Babylonians. The 10 northern tribes were overtaken by the Assyrian Empire in the 9th century before Christ, and the 2 southern tribes were overrun about 200 years later. The Babylonians decided it would be good to spread the Israelites around their empire so they wouldn't cause as much trouble as they had inside their fortified cities. This was known as the exile in the Babylonian captivity. During the approach to the Babylonian captivity, we meet another Jewish heroine in the book of Judith. This is one of the books excluded from the Protestant Bible because some scholars believe it is not historical. But it tells of a time when Holofernes, a general under King Nebuchadnezzar of Assyria, has Israel under siege, and the leaders are sure the city will be destroyed if they don't surrender. But Judith travels to Holofernes' tent and lets him get drunk, thinking he will have his way with her. Then she cuts off his head, puts it in a bag, takes it home to the city, and shows it to the Israelites, so that they know that God has delivered them from their enemies, even when they were greatly outnumbered. In pagan history, the king of Persia has now conquered Babylon, and King Darius is the king of Persia, who allows the Israelites to return home. And under the leadership of Ezra, the Israelites return home and they rebuild the temple. Jerusalem continued as a city, but the region was always under the thumb of some empire. After the Persians were the Greeks. Alexander the Great had an empire that stretched from Morocco to India. Everybody there spoke Greek the way everybody today speaks English, even if it's not their native language. During the Assyrian domination, we read some of the great stories from the book of Daniel. Some of these you'll remember. Daniel is thrown into a lion's den because he will not abandon his religion, but God protects him. The 3 young men are thrown into the fiery furnace for the same reason, but an angel comes to be with them, and they are not harmed by the fire. Later, a man named Belshazzar decides to use the sacred vessels that they had stolen from the Jewish temple. He used those for his feast, and suddenly a hand appears and writes on the wall. And he can't read the handwriting on the wall. And he asks for Daniel to come and explain the message. And the message is that the Assyrian Empire will give way to the Babylonians. It is during the Babylonian captivity that we meet another Jewish heroine. This time it is Esther. The bad guy here is a man named Haman, who convinces the king Ahasuerus, who we know as Xerxes, to outlaw the Jewish religion, because he thinks that a Jew named Mordecai was disrespectful to him. But Mordecai's niece is Esther, who has been chosen on account of her beauty and grace to be the new queen. And she skillfully leads the king to realize that Haman is the bad guy and Mordecai is the good guy. And in the end, Haman is hung from the gallows that he had built to hang Mordecai. The Israelites had always gotten into trouble whenever they chose to blend in with the customs of their neighbors or their overlords. And it was no different when their overlords were Greek. The books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees tell the story of the tension between those Jews who favored Hellenizing and those who were willing to go to war to be free to worship God as he asked to be worshipped. After the Greeks came the Romans, but we don't meet them until we get to the New Testament. I mentioned at the beginning of our talk that three of the gospel stories are very similar in their approach and their timeline and even their precise word choices. From these three synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we get a picture of a child born in Bethlehem and raised in Nazareth in Galilee, around the Sea of Galilee, which is also called the Sea of Tiberias. In these Gospels, Jesus begins his ministry at approximately the age of 30 in those northern villages and territories. After some time, he tells his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, where he will be handed over and killed. This has been our Sunday reading just a month or so ago. Jesus does go to Jerusalem, and he is initially welcomed, but quickly handed over to the religious and political authorities for execution. He is seen 3 days later, and then many times over the next 40 days, when in the presence of his apostles, he ascends to the Father in heaven. The Gospel of John is written in a different style, and John doesn't waste much time building up to the events in Jerusalem. John repeatedly makes connections between events in the Old Testament and the life and ministry of Jesus of Nazareth. Where in Mark's passion and in Luke's passion and in Matthew's passion, the suffering of Jesus is made crystal clear, in John's passion, the power of Jesus is made crystal clear. John's gospel does not include the words of institution at the Last Supper as the other three do. But it does include a multi-chapter speech by Jesus in which he instructs his disciples and gives them sort of his last will and testament. The second part of Luke's gospel is called the Acts of the Apostles, and it tells us about the very early days of the church. We meet Saul, who is a devout Jew and considers the followers of Jesus to be heretics, and he assists in their discovery and their death. He is there when St. Stephen preaches a sermon and is stoned to death because of what he preached. Saul has a conversion experience in Damascus, and he is given a new name, Paul. And Paul is called to preach the good news to the Gentiles, those nations not familiar with the Hebrew God. The book of the Acts includes the very first ecumenical council of the church, held in Jerusalem, to decide how much of a good Jew a good Christian must be. For some thought that a Christian was still bound by the law of Moses, but Paul showed them that the law had been fulfilled in Christ and was therefore no longer required of any pagan convert. The letters of Paul and of Peter and of John are mainly letters of introduction or letters of response to a pastoral issue that has come up in the various church communities to whom they're addressed or around the Eastern Mediterranean. The last book of the Bible is called the Apocalypse or Revelation, because that's what the Greek word apocalypse means. It means unveiling. The Apocalypse is a multifaceted book that includes words of comfort and consolation to seven church cities in modern-day Turkey, and then follows with a vision of two things: the power and majesty of the end of creation and the power and majesty of the heavenly banquet. It concludes with the great battle between the forces of evil and good, and we win. So that is the race through the Bible. I've hardly given you anything more than a few of the greatest hits, and I promise you will enjoy reading it and discovering the many ways in which God is communicating through his Holy Scriptures how much he loves us and cares for us. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm happy to take questions. So. stop this.